accession number 22100, rule 6.
Reel 3, side 2, Lieutenant Gordon Cantley.
If there were mines in the verges or that sort of stuff, we used to either lift them, or if there were shoe mines, we would blow them with Cortex and generally get the thing moving again. One of our sister squadron, they had lost one or two people, and one of the new troop leaders was a chap called Campbell, who was the son of the chief engineer. And he hadn't learnt this lesson long enough when he approached a roadblock and got shot to pieces. So you did learn your lessons fairly quickly as to how to go about this particular exercise. Whether the others did what I did, I've no idea, but that was my modus operandi. And we did this, you know, for tree blocks fairly regularly. There was one time when we came up to a blown bridge with a railway. And the railway was in cutting, obviously, with the blown bridge, and doing the same sort of operation. Suddenly out of the ditch appeared a chappie with his bazooka, but the tank had put the wind up him, so he surrendered to me, and that was my first and only prisoner. Now, at that particular one, I couldn't do anything with the bridge. It needed bridging, but I noticed on my map that the railway, of course, passed out onto open ground down to the side, and about a mile or so down a track there was a level crossing. So I went to the leading squadron leader. I said, look, this is a level crossing. He looked at me in utter surprise. I don't think he realized it was a level crossing. The skill of map reading of some of the cars wasn't so good. Anyway, he said the brigadier's just back there. He said, go and tell the brigadier and get yourself an MC. So I trotted off down there. By that time, of course, the brigadier had disappeared. But obviously, he told his battalion commander. So all of a sudden, we all turned right and we trotted across this thing and we moved across this level crossing, and we caught the German column going out the back end, which pleased the commander of the Irish Guards quite a lot. Anyway, that was that, and then. There were other occasions. There was one occasion where we'd been stopped for some reason or another. I don't know why. And my sappers had gone into a house, and I had stayed outside in the armored car with the wireless on. And all of a sudden, I was getting shot at by shellfire. This one gun was starting to pick on me. It eventually rattled the armoured car and broke my windscreen. I thought, oh, this is time to move. So I moved along from there. That's the only time that the Germans have really had their eye on me. Now, at least to my knowledge. The other thing which happened was that later on, in support of the Grenadiers, Tony was withdrawn because he was regular. He was going to be regular and he was going to the Far East. So it must have been getting towards near the end of the war. And pushed up to support the Grenadiers, and they were stopped by a roadblock, which was a timbered roadblock. They used to put timbers into the road and then close it off with vertical horizontal ones. And those mines, shoe mines and everything around about here. So I said to the looker, if you're passing your infantry round, pass them wide. And this young Grenadier officer hadn't listened, so one of his blokes walked into the shoe mines and lost his foot, which I then gallantly went in and put him on my back and pulled him out and stuffed him full of morphia. And then we blew the roadblock and went away. We had another occasion where, again, it was a double roadblock of this sort of form, and we'd been stopped at the lower roadblock. It was obviously under fire, so I wasn't doing anything about it until it was clear and happy. And the 3rd Irish put in an attack up the right-hand side. But before they did it, the CRE, who was now my old OC, Major Thomas, had now been appointed CRE, and Splosh Jones had been appointed to staff at 30 Corps. He was very good, Splosh Jones. So was John Thomas. And he said, "Why are you cleaning this roadblock?" I said, "Because it's under fire." He said, "Oh, walk with me." So we walked up, and we got a burst of spandau between the two of us. So that was enough. No, not a word was said. We just walked back. But anyway, when the Irish had gone up to the second roadblock by attacking up the right-hand side, we cleared this one. And then I moved up again to the next one, and it didn't look too good either, because nobody had been working on the left-hand side, and it was a high bank on the left-hand side and trees on the right-hand side, and there was a house down below. So I put my sappers into the house, put a brain gun on the tables, look out there in case the Germans are coming that way whilst we clear the roadblock. Well, I could see these bloody Germans moving through these trees. So I moved back and picked up my driver Todd. He was a mad devil, little man, and he took the brain gun out of the armoured car, and I took a handful of 36 grenades, and he fired the brain, dashed up and fired the brain. I dashed up through the grenades, none of which exploded. So we carried on at this for a little bit, and nothing happened, and then it all seemed to quieten down, and the OC came up and said, let's get the roadblock cleared. So we cleared that, and that was another day gone. But the whole operation was, you would go along and you would lose your lead tank, if not the lead, the first two, three, you would lose them, and then you would be stopped because the Germans would have a tank or an anti-tank gun judiciously located, and then when they stopped you, they would move back and do the same thing the next day. So you were moving between roadblocks or knocked out tanks, and it was very distressing and very tiring. Anyway, we one day they managed to get this bloody tank, and they brought in these four very young black-clad German youths. Black-clad because, not because they were SS, but black-clad because they were armour, I think. But anyway, they gave each of them a shovel and told them to dig their own grave, because they were cocky little bastards. They dug their own grave, and they were not quite so cocky before they were shoved away. But that was one other thing which happened. And then there was another exercise which occurred towards the end of the war, where I think we were having an awful lot of trouble. Our division was moving up between Bremen and Hamburg, up towards Cuxhaven, and we were fighting 21 Panzer, we were fighting the German Marines and the German Navy, and they were using ship magnetic mines, so that if your X number of tanks would go past, and then the next one would go up, and it would lift that tank into the next field, a really bloody great hole it would make. And there was one road with 9 of these holes in it, and I remember the sign said, "For 1 mile, this road is bloody." And it really was true. But to cut a long story short, then, we were having all this trouble, and the Household Cavalry had discovered a bridge which was blown, but it was not guarded way round to our right, again within this peninsula. And The object was then to pass an armoured column round over that bridge and get behind the Germans, which were sitting and blocking us on the way. I was sent out with my armoured section again out into the wild blue yonder in the daylight. Nothing to be seen there. And I got to this place, and I saw the Household Cavalry commander, another lieutenant. And we looked at this thing here, and this bridge was down a sort of an embanked road with fields on either side, about 50 to 100 yards, and the bridge was blown further up. So the place was very quiet and didn't look good at all. So I suggested we go down in his Dingo. He had Dingo armoured cars. So we got into this, and he was driving, and then all of a sudden there was a hell of a bang. And I looked at him and said, "Well, I don't know about you, but I'm getting out." So out I got, and he followed very quickly, and we got back. And to cut a long story short, I did eventually walk up to the bridge and had a look at the gap and measured it up and decided it was going to need an 80-foot double single. Then I was preparing to walk back, and I looked down and I saw these bloody mines, and these mines, instead of being anti-tank, had been converted to anti-personnel by putting a push igniter on top. So if you stood on the thing, you really were going to heaven. Anyway, I was very much more careful walking back down. So back I go to the CRE and say, it's an 80-foot double single. Sure, that's fine. You take a bridging troop out tonight and build it, you see. So, all right. So we pick up this Canadian bridging troop, and I've now got my whole troop with me. You know, three sections of sappers, about 30 or 40 sappers, and off we go out into the wild blue yonder at night. And we get to the bridging point, and this bridging troop has a crane with it. Now, the British Army never let you use a crane, you always do by hand, but this bridging guy had a crane on it. And unfortunately, the first thing we did, we backed this crane over a mine. Which wasn't very good. However, we then set to and we cleared the mines, and then we built the bridge, and we were all ready to go back home again. And this was, you know, late at night, early morning. And on the way up, there had been a crossroads with a village on it, very quiet. And then, not very far away from the bridge, but a mile short of the bridge, there had been an incoming T junction road. So I said, look, I will lead with number 5 section, which was the other armoured section, Corporal Pratt's section. And when we get to that bridge, Corporal Pratt will drive into that, and he will block that road if anybody comes down to shoot you up as you come past. So we went off like this, and we were driving along quite steadily, and then all of a sudden, there was a hell of a bang. We'd passed this, and we were getting up towards this crossroads. So I thought, well, something's gone. So I carried on, followed by a section of sappers and some of the bridging lorries, and stopped in the town crossroads and told my sappers to get out and form a hard point around this crossroads. And as I was doing this, of course, a DR, we never had DRs either, a Canadian dispatch rider came belting up and said, we've lost a lorry. I said, I just heard that. So I got on his pillion and we went back up there, and he'd either gone to sleep or something, but he'd gone off onto the verge and he'd blown a wheel. So we swept the mines, pulled them to the side and laid them to the side, marked pine verges and left this blazing lorry, and went home. Ready to go to sleep. He said, right, dear, you're joining the Irish group who's going across this bridge that you've just built. So my armour section, myself, set across there, and we got up. But although we got round towards the back of the Germans, they had withdrawn from that particular position. So although it was an exercise, it was just an exercise. That really is getting towards the end of the war. And I think by that time I was getting a bit sort of a... I know I had eczema on my chin, which is, of course, a symbol of stress and strain. I think that most of us were, well, in fact, my lead section was getting so weary that they made me take, well, they didn't make me, but they asked me to take the other armoured section, Corporal Pratt's section, and a couple of advances, but to give them a rest, which I did. But we also built one or two bridges out there. But that really is about the end of the war. So when the war came to an end, we were up heading towards Cuxhaven, and that's really where it all finished. We had, I remember, as good a meal as we could possibly have on the night of VE, before VE Day, only to be told that for VE Day I had to take my troop up and fill in some bomb craters near these enormous mine craters near Stade. So I didn't see very much of VE Day, but that was the end of the war. Is that it?
Just to round it off, once the war had finished, what happened to you then? How much longer did you serve?
The war finished in April 1945. what did we do then? We stayed for a short time up in that neck of the woods, and then we moved down to a very pleasant place called Königswinter, which is near Bad Godesberg on the Rhine. At that particular place, this would be, I suppose, in May. In that particular place, we were briefed to open up the motorway. So we spent some time, not working at night, but working by day in getting the motorway open, putting in bridges, putting in diversions, etc., etc. I always remember there was one bridge, which was a reinforced concrete bridge, which had been demolished, or an attempt at demolition, by putting a couple of bombs on the top of it, so they'd blown a couple of holes in it, and it didn't look a big gap at all. But Corporal Pratt was put on this bridge to clear it away, and before he'd finished, he got some of what was called Pratt's Gulch. We had to put a bailey across this after his efforts. Pratt's Gulch. He's a hell of a man. But anyway, we did that for some time. It was a very pleasant mess that we had there. The first time we had an officer's mess, really, since the beginning of the war. Eventually then, I was posted in June or July, I can't remember which, to 7th Armoured. Guards Armoured were reverting to infantry. And one of the things which happened before we had moved down to Königswinter was the giving up of the armour, which was very cleverly done. It was done on an airfield, and there was a bit of a bank, so the tanks drove over this bank, and then everybody marched back. So they went out as armour, and they came back as infantry in front of Montgomery. It was quite well done, as they did these things very well, the guards. You're never frightened being with a Guards regiment or a Guards battalion. You knew that they weren't going to run. That was it. They maybe weren't the fastest at movers, but they weren't going to run. That was it. But anyway, after that, Königswinter, repairing the bridges, I was posted to 7th Armoured, and 7th Armoured was stationed up on the Kiel Canal in Schleswig-Holstein. I was given a troop of one of the squadrons up there. I think it was 4th Field Squadron. I was with them until, I think, around about Christmas. And then I was sent on a field engineering course to Ripon. I think the thought process was that I would be posted to the School of Military Engineering, which was going to be formed at Hameln, you know, the rat place. But anyway, when I was at Ripon doing this field engineering course, I was promoted to 2IC of the field park. So I went back to join the field park squadron as 2IC. But in fact, we really never had an OC. So in fact, I was OC 2IC in General Dog's Body of the field park for the rest of the time I was in the army. We moved to near Hamburg at one particular time, but then we moved down to the Elbe, and the field park was the first British unit against the Russians. Just around the corner was the Russian border, but we'd never had any trouble with them. Whilst we were there, the divisional RE, the 7th Armoured Division RE, built a bridge across the Elbe further down towards Hamburg, and being field park, we had to supply them with all their kit and equipment. That was about the end of it. We had some quite pleasant weekends, not too many, at the Atlantic Hotel in Hamburg, and we could go up to Hamburg and have a meal again at the Atlantic Hotel. Even visited the opera occasionally. So it became a bit more civilized towards the end of the war. We were, of course, discharging people, and I remember at the place where We were stationed near the Kiel Canal, a miserable little hole called Lockstedter Lager. Two things happened there. There was an old German dump of ammunition, which was under the charge of the ordnance people, and they were collecting ordnance and bringing it to this sort of dump. And all of a sudden, the CO sitting in my office in this requisitioned house, the CO of this ordnance came tearing into me. So he says, "It's all going to blow up. It's all going to blow up." And I said, "Well, we better open the windows." Which he turned around and went away. It seemed that they'd brought in a lorry load and something that was smoking, and he got frightened out. Well, we better open the windows. That calmed him down. But anyway, the bridging equipment was in a wooden hut, a wooden, big long wooden hut, and that caught fire. It was freezing. And although there was certainly no fraternization, obviously, as was the rule in the Guards, there was plenty of fraternization in 7th Armoured. We had an awful lot of trouble with the people making friends with the better-looking Germans. In fact, when the first party of sappers was due to be discharged, the first large group, I said, "All right, you can have a party in the mess, the corporal's mess. They will let you have a party in their mess for that time." And it got out of hand completely. There was lots of things said there. So I said, "That's the last time we have a party."
So moving on, you were demobilised when?
In September.
And you returned to?
I went back to university.
Okay. One final question, on a technical note. You've referred a lot in this interview to the times when you were clearing mines. What techniques did you use? Did you dig for them by hand? Did you detect them by hand? Did you have mine detectors?
We had mine detectors. And generally, the mines we were after were anti-tank mines. The anti-personnel mines were merely supplementary. You might get anti-personnel mines in the verges at a roadblock, but we soon learnt this and we kept off the verges. And you could recognise them because they didn't have a great deal of time to prepare them, so you could see the little pockets, if you understand what I mean. But the main ones were anti-tank mines. We had mostly teller mines, which were fairly easy, but we used to pull them. We would take the fuse out, and then we would hook on a wire and a cable and pull it in case they had booby-trapped the mine. So we normally pulled rather than lifted. Another mine which we came across was the Regal mine, R-I-E-G-A-L, I think it was called, the Regal mine, which was a long box, about a metre long, about 6 inches by 6 inches, and it was a very sensitive mine. And to lift that was a bit of a problem. You had to lift that, and you had to carry it away by laying it on somebody's arms, you know, and then somebody would come and take it off you again. We had a bit of fun with that, though. When we got those, we used to take them to the side and poop them off, and if the Germans were wide awake, as they normally were, they would normally shell that burst, which was quite interesting. But then towards the latter end of the war, we were coming against wooden box mines, but we didn't get many of those, because normally we were on hard roads, and you could see where the mine was in the hard roads. It was the shoe mines that gave us trouble in the verges. But normally we could see where the mines were, so we could deal with them fairly easily. And as I say, if we were poking for mines, then we had to use a prodder. We had a prodder thing which you prodded for the mine, but that was a dangerous old business.